welcome to a very special edition of Talking Natural Capital. That's right, it's our 2021 Christmas special. We've only made three episodes so far, but I'm delighted to say that it's put us amongst the greats of The Office and the Royal Family Christmas specials. And I've sporadically put on my Christmas jumper today. My co-host, Eleanor Harris, is looking even more Christmassy than myself. So, Eleanor, welcome to the Christmas edition.
Hello. Season's greetings. Merry Christmas. Can we say that yet? Because we've got a few days to go yet. Yeah, I've got my, I am the Christmas tree. I've got my Christmas lights on. I've got my woolly hat on because I think we'll be going out into the countryside. Brought some friends with me. So we've got a wee Christmas party going on here. And we've got a Christmas tree and quite excited that we've all brought some presents to put around it.
As you say, we've got a few people to meet first, so I'll get the ball rolling first off. Emma Chalmers.
Hello.
Thank you for coming on the show. And Hugo Remnant.
Hello, Matt. Good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you on. So, Eleanor, can you tell us a little bit about what we're doing today?
There's so much to talk about with natural capital. Where do you begin? And I thought for our episode three and the Christmas episode, to get a sort of sense of the range of things that we talk about here in Galbraith when we talk about natural capital. And the fact that it's all about, it's really all about producing good things, and it's about living a good life. And so to put that into something tangible, what better than Christmas presents? We've brought a Christmas tree out of a sustainably managed forest and some things that we're going to put around it.
Why do you feel it's quite important that people understand what we're trying to do today?
Christmas is such a special time. It's a time when material things have an awful lot of meaning. We have this special food and the whole idea of gift giving, and we go to special places and we decorate our homes. But on the other hand, we've got the criticism of Christmas as being very consumerist, all the hype around the Black Friday sales and the Boxing Day sales and everyone rushing to get the latest things. And for me, it's always been a really special time. I'm a singer, so I love the whole carol singing element of it, and I love the food and the company and the whole story of Christmas. But to me, it really it chimes very much with the whole idea of the earth and of the earth providing for us, and that turning of the year. We're thinking about the changing seasons. That really comes to the fore when you're working with farmers and foresters. And so I'd like to share some of that.
We'll get the ball rolling with our first Christmas gift. First off, Hugo Remnant, can I just get a little bit about what you do for Galbraith and what you've brought to the table?
Thank you, Matt. So I work in the north of England out of the Hexham office. I manage a number of privately owned estates between the Scottish borders down to North Yorkshire. And I also do a whole range of professional work, some valuation work, and I'm hoping to embark on a bit of natural capital work and building on that new line of work for us in the future. What I brought to the party today is a leg of lamb. And the story of my lamb is that we have a tiny field. I mean, it's less than an acre. It's by the river, which we sort of manage for the wildflowers. I've got a neighbour, he's got hundreds of sheep, and he's very happy to put a few of his sheep into my field, but he doesn't really like my grass because it's too long for sheep, ideally, and he tends to take them out far too soon from my point of view, because I want them to get a bit hungry before they get removed, and so that everything's been really well grazed down. So this year, I've decided to buy my own sheep, which is a new venture. And I bought four store lambs and got signed up and registered to the land, the field, the property, the farm. What I hope to get is we're going to get four lambs to put in the deep freeze. And I'm hoping we're going to get a markedly improved wildflower meadow. Not everybody can do this, of course. We're very lucky to have the field. The provenance of the meat is totally known. It's not officially organic, but I know that effectively it is. It's all part of a journey, really, to do the business of a natural wildflower meadow a lot better. And I'm hoping to learn a lot and just see what comes through next summer.
Does the grass grow back better next year? Have you effectively got, as it were, free lamb because there's going to be more growth of the grass thanks to the grazing?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So what's going to come in the spring? One of the measures I could take is to graze it again in the spring, because I think the first plants to move will be the vigorous grasses. So if you were finessing this, I think you would get some stock back on early, just as the grasses are beginning to move. And then, of course, you have to take them off before the wildflowers want to come, or else they get eaten off before they've had a chance to get away. And that doesn't really suit me, because what I want to do is get some stall lambs in August and kill them in November. And then I'm not carrying stock right through the year. I'm not getting into a breeding program. And I think buying more stall lambs in the spring to fatten, it might work, but I haven't really thought of it. I thought I would see what will come. I'm pretty sure that, unless I've really overdone it with the grazing this autumn, I'm pretty sure we're going to get a wider variety of what we really want botanically with the wildflowers, and more of them.
What kind of sheep are they?
We have some friends up in the hills on the Otterburn Ranges who, they brought me some Cheviot stores, North Country Cheviots. But they took one look at the field, which is bordered on one side by what looks to me like a river that can't easily be swum by a sheep, and a dry stone wall that looks plenty big enough for me. And they said, Hugo, these sheep will be straight out. So we got quite excited about the arrival of these hefted animals. They were taken away, and I found some Beltex crosses from down country, and they are very placid and friendly, and they definitely won't climb a wall or swim a river. So but what's interesting there is that I thought the North Country Cheviots would be less fussy about long grass, because, you know, this is not a sheep pasture. It looks all wrong. So I've had to change and see how the Beltex crosses have got on, and they've absolutely thrived. So perhaps there's a lesson in there about can we grow the grass a bit longer?
And the wildlife, presumably your insect life, will improve with your increased flora from your wildflower meadow.
So we've done a wildflower survey. I've got a list, and it runs to 70 or 80 different plants, I think. And we haven't done that for the insects. I do see bats. You see a few swallows, house martins, insect feeders, in other words. It's very hard to say. It'll be very hard to measure, won't it? It'll be very hard to tell if we've got more insects. My feeling is that it's a bit of an indulgence, isn't it? Because it's a tiny area, and in the whole scheme of things, it's small, and it's not going to make a great deal of difference. But I think we can learn a lot by doing exactly what you're suggesting, Emma, asking ourselves other questions, and then deciding how we're going to answer them, and maybe measurement of other creatures is something that we should do.
I think it's engagement. By us being engaged, even if it's a small project, we have an understanding because it's practical. We then can talk about it. And then other people who perhaps have the opportunity for a bigger scale are then talking about it. And it's that spreading of that message. It's from that old adage, from little acorns. And I follow that. I am a great believer that from small acorns comes mighty oaks. And by doing our small part, I think it's all part of the whole change that we're seeing, this massive sea change in mindset, and the, you know, even down to packaging. You know, I'm noticing Christmas wrapping paper hasn't got plastic around it. And, you know, we did a wildflower meadow this year. We had a patch of ground, and my husband rotivated it, and he sowed all the seed, and he spent 2 months getting crosser and crosser because there were no flowers. And then all of a sudden the flowers arrived, and it's the most beautiful. It was the most beautiful sort of strip of wildflowers. And asking about the insects was because I would go and have a look and I'd start picking some flowers to bring into the house. And I would see three or four different bees because the different flora were bringing in the different bees. And that made me think, actually, all these little things are adding to the biodiversity of our immediate environment.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've got two questions on that. One, I wonder what your husband will have to do to manage for wildflowers, because you tend to get a really good take in the first year because you prepared the ground perfectly so that they can germinate and thrive. But of course, I've talked quite a lot about the vigorous competing grasses at home, and I imagine that will begin to play at your place. It'll be interesting to see what comes next year. Secondly, the Game Conservancy put out something literally in the last day or two saying that grass margins to arable fields, they've done some research and have found significantly higher populations of insects on those compared to ordinary pasture, if you like. And they link that to the decline of many insect feeding birds, particularly the swallows and house martins, which are down over the last 30 years by about, by in the order of 35%. So it has to make a difference. And people do ask, because our field is bordered by a lane, which quite a lot of people from the village walk up, particularly in lockdown. But we had a lot more people walking up, and they do look over and they ask, and they say, what is that funny tube on a stake sticking up? And I say, that's for the mallard. That's a nesting tube. And the fact that we didn't have anything nesting in it year one sort of doesn't matter. I don't think they'll come on that site. I think they might come in other sites at home, but it doesn't matter because it's generating interest and a question, and people are asking about it. And I think you're making a very good point about engagement. That's exactly what is happening.
The point about the next year is absolutely correct, because there is a huge amount of consideration now. What do we do next year? Do we leave it? Do we plant more seed? The theory is it should come back, but you're right, we've got this grass that could easily appear because, you know, it was a field margin at one point because we bought our neighbour's field. So this bit of ground is a former field margin, and it is full of tussocky thick grass. So yes, next year is going to be utterly fascinating. And, you know, if it doesn't come back, there will be a very cross husband. And we'll be discussing what's going to happen, because he'll want it back again. So yes, the science will go on next year.
Right, well, that's one podcast next year sorted out. We'll get you two back and we'll have an update.
I'd love to, Eleanor.
I'm loving the dreams of wildflower meadows and bees and nesting birds, but I'm also getting impatient for my next present under the tree. So. I'm wondering if we could move on to Emma, and you haven't had a chance to introduce yourself yet, so please do that, and please.
So I am Emma Chalmers, interrupting Hugo already with joining in my usual way. I'm based in Perthshire, so I sort of cover over the whole of Perthshire, a wee up into Angus, over into Fife, and I've specialised in the valuation and the sales of all rural property. That's my bag. So if you've got an estate or a farm or a country house or a field that needs valued or to be sold, or you want to find a buyer, I'm the person to speak to. And under the tree, I am bringing a large basket of homegrown fruit. And the reason I'm bringing you a basket of homegrown fruit is that when we bought our field, which I've already mentioned, from our neighbour, our lovely farming neighbour, we decided to plant some fruit trees because my husband has a great love of fruit trees. So we planted a collection of fruit trees, and then our neighbour kindly said that we could buy a bit more of the field. So we bought more of the field and we bought the wood. So we now sit with just over 7 acres, and we have a orchard that we have created in the former beetle bank that we call it. And we've got a new orchard that we created where the hens and the ducks live. And the fruit trees are part of the sort of longer term vision that we have here at home, where we will have the sort of increased opportunity for biodiversity and for nature and for wildlife. And my eldest son wants to keep bees, and I'm an avid hedge planter, so I've got, you know, 60 meters of hedging to plant this Christmas holidays. And it's all part of that desire to do our little bit to help sustain our own immediate environment. And I live in rural Perthshire with arable fields around me, and there's field margins, and there's lovely old mature woodlands, and this is just our little bit of the countryside at our back door. And that's why I'm bringing you apples of all sorts of different varieties, which are native to Britain, and plums and greengages and quince, and I've now got a mulberry tree and a walnut tree. Yeah, the list is quite endless. And then there's the fruit bushes. So yes, I am an avid cook and baker, and so all of the ingredients come into the house as well. So yes.
You told me you've got some in your mince pies.
Yes, I made my pies, I got up early hungry. On Sunday. I suddenly realised I hadn't made my mincemeat for the mince pies. So I got up early and then went off to my basket, because I keep the apples when autumn comes. You know, we eat a lot of the apples, but I keep quite a few, and so I went off to my cooking apple basket and got a few to put into my mincemeat. So yes,
the question that I was thinking, this is a question for Emma, but it's going to be one for Hugo as well, actually, is I'm a city girl, I live in a flat, and I hope lots of the listeners to this podcast are people who live in cities, and we're all one step removed from this. We haven't got our own patch of land, we can't raise our own sheep or grow our own fruit trees. This sounds wonderful, but what about me? You know, where can I get local, fresh, organically grown food like this? You know, what kind of systems do we need to create? What kind of changes do we need in our food systems so that many more of us can enjoy this kind of local, low food miles, low input food, rather than stuff brought from around the world or highly processed food out of season?
Yeah, I mean, really good question. Of course, it's quite a difficult one, isn't it? Because it's all very well me pontificating, living where I do with space. But I think Emma started on this by talking about engagement. But it's a bit more than that. It's questioning what we're doing, isn't it? And doing what we can. I think the more difficult aspect to this is, it's, if you like, not that hard for me to get some sheep. You know, I have the butchery skills, and my wife has the cooking skills. But is it a bit like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic? Because I drove to work in a car with an internal combustion engine. I heat my house with diesel. And I would very much like to go and visit my brother in Australia. And that'll mean flying. And those are the really big issues. And actually, when it comes to it, I try and engage with friends about this. And it's very hard to do so without appearing to be morally superior. And I don't mean to do that at all. I just want to have the discussion, because I'm as bad at addressing those big issues as everybody else. And I think that's the slightly troubling aspect of all of this. If it's the start of a journey and it's small steps to begin with, that's all fine. But I think the real challenge is to do a lot more, which will involve a major change in all of our lifestyles.
I couldn't agree more, Hugo. And I sense from all the press and the television coverage of the COP26 issues that were really strongly highlighted to us as people and as a country, there is definitely an understanding of the issues in a far more widespread way than it has been to date. And I suppose I can say that because I've, you know, 6 months ago, we were talking as a business about natural capital, and I would have friends say to me, what are you talking about? And I don't understand. And COP26 came along, and now they're all saying, oh, I get this natural capital thing, Emma. I see what you're talking about. And I was saying to farmers 6 months ago, well, I think, you know, the day of the plough is nigh. We will not have a plough in 20 years' time. And they were like, I'm not giving up my plough. And I had a farmer friend talk to me and he said, I was talking to my agronomist and, you know, he's been explaining min-till to me. And, you know, I think that's the way it's going to go, Emma. And that's in the course of 6 months. So I think Hugo's right. We all have to play our part. We all have to make sea changes, some of which will be seismic, from our cars to our heating of our houses. There is still technology to come. We don't have all the technology that's going to solve the problems, but we know there's technology being developed and evolved that will help the process. But going back to your question about, you know, us all being part of a sustainable system from a food point of view, you know, there's very basic things that the large supermarkets could do to help. So having a very strong network of British supplies will be very important. Not having a criteria about the shape of a carrot or an apple is very important, because we don't need a uniformed carrot for a stew. It just needs to be a carrot that's nicely grown and still fresh. And also supporting our British farmers. And you look at the supermarket advertising and they are definitely supporting the British farmer. But we have, as our colleagues have said, some of the most sustainable food that we produce in this country. And we should be eating it and happy to eat it and not flying an avocado from the other side of the world that we know is, it requires a huge amount of energy to grow. So I would be saying now, and we've watched people like Hugh Farnley-Whittingstall challenge the farming fraternity, no, the supermarkets, to support the British farmer. And I think that will happen probably quicker now, but that's probably the most effective way for us to see a change.
If we've got time, I've got a little present as well. I thought we'd better have three. So, and it's actually, it's very much the same theme. I hope that you'll see that the story is very much the same, because like Good King Wenceslas, I've brought some logs for the fire. Very old fashioned form of heating, firewood, but lots of people like to have a wood burner, and especially in the countryside, it's a great way to get rural properties off oil to use wood instead. And even in suburbs and towns, we like to have a fire. The important thing, of course, is that the firewood is well seasoned, and that's been we've heard a lot about that in policy this year, that burning poorly seasoned firewood causes air pollution. So it's really important to make sure that our logs have been correctly dried, and it should have a certification label on to say that. So that's that technical stuff out of the way. But what these logs are doing is they're the product of bringing neglected native woodland into management. And this is one of my favourite habitats from a biodiversity point of view, but it's also one of our most neglected habitats. And there are a lot of farm woodlands in the UK that really aren't producing anything. The farmer isn't quite sure what to do with them. They're just neglected and not looked after. And by starting to produce firewood, that's a way of starting to produce income and starting to produce a product. By thinning out the woodland to produce the firewood, you enable the remaining trees to grow faster. So in the longer run, your forest should actually become a better carbon capturing factory than it was before, and you should, the remaining trees, you know, if it's done well and you select the right trees, then you should end up with, you know, the big trees that that you want in the native woodland. You're also opening up the canopy. Many native woodlands are too crowded, trees are too close together, and then the ground flora can't grow as it should. So by thinning it and taking some of the wood out, you allow a bit of light in, and then the flowers can grow, and then that brings the pollinators and the insects and the birds and everything that lives upon them. So that's a bit like Hugo's lambs that are really creating a wildflower meadow, and Emma's fruit that's really, again, creating hedgerows and orchards where there was plough land. I'm bringing these logs that are really creating an upgraded and cared for native woodland.
I think what you highlight is the choice we have between total withdrawal, so we We withdraw from the land, we close the gate behind us, we lock it, we throw the key away and allow nature to take its course? Or do we manage it in the way that we really have always managed the land, and there really is, that there's no land in this country which isn't, hasn't been managed and isn't managed today in one way or another? And as a land manager myself, I believe in the power of managing for certain objectives, certain results that we want. And that is almost never achieved by withdrawing. And I would say all those actions and measures that you've mentioned have a role. You just need to be absolutely clear what you're trying to achieve. Just like the groundswell guys down in Hertfordshire, they were the first in the regenerative agriculture field. And when they started telling everybody about it 5 years ago, because they'd already been doing it for 10 years, they found that there were a lot of other people who were beginning to think along the same lines and are doing the same thing by way of giving up a plough, as Emma was saying earlier. So there's a really good example of trying something, finding out what worked, what didn't, learning, adjusting, adapting, doing it better, getting better results, and then improving on that. And I think that's the way we're going to move on all of these things.
That's exactly what I was thinking as you were talking at the beginning, is that there's so much experiment going on. There's almost everything that both of you were saying was about, we're trying this out, we're not sure if it's going to work, we're going to see what happens next year, we need to do some monitoring. And that's what it's like here in Galbraith, doing Natural Capital, seeing all these projects going on, is it's all at the forefront, it's all the cutting edge. And we're doing it on this land that that has been so changed by humans over the centuries and millennia. And I think we often think of woodland as a separate and kind of more wild habitat, but actually the woodlands that I'm talking about, that I'm envisaging and that are being producing firewood, they're not wild woods. They were planted by somebody a century ago or 50 years ago for shelter or for some purpose, or maybe for a government grant. And now they're there. They're not intact ecosystems. Humans are a part of them. They're probably, chances are they're quite young in woodland terms. They probably haven't got 400-year-old trees in them. And they're probably quite even aged. They might not have a good range of species. And so actually we can, also they're likely to have things like deer coming along and grey squirrel coming in, eating them, and which don't have their own natural predators. So we, for better or worse, you know, we play that role of managing, of being top predator, of doing things that geology or climate would do over thousands of years. We can speed that up, and we can, we've inherited a landscape where we have to make those interventions. And if it's sheep, then it seems quite natural that you move the sheep around and you plant hedgerows and you make quite detailed interventions. And I think it's just the same with these native woodlands, that that we can speed up the restoration of those ecological processes by what we do. And then perhaps the final Christmas gift is that all these things, what stands out is they're greater than the sum of the parts. It's not just a leg of lamb, it's a leg of lamb and wildflowers and better use of the grass resource, so that you're reducing imports from somewhere else and lots of other things. And that's the same with the fruit. It's not just fruit, it's a landscape and the firewood as well. So that's natural capital management at its best, I think. And that's what we're all pursuing, is that synergy and that multiplication of the benefits.
Folks, it's been great hearing your ideas for the Christmas tree. It's great to hear the discussions. Emma and Hugo will definitely have you on again in the new year for more discussions as well, which will be really insightful. Hugo, finally, just thank you very much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on. I've really enjoyed the discussion. We've really barely scratched the surface, haven't we? So I'd look forward to continuing the discussion and comparing notes with Emma and Eleanor and others.
I wholeheartedly agree with all that Hugo has said. It's been an absolute delight. And yes, very much look forward to us doing this again. So thank you again.
Emma, perfect. Thank you very much. And Eleanor, of course, always a pleasure.
Yes, and I love introducing new guests. So I hope we'll bring in more in the new year, but definitely we'll be getting Hugo and Emma back to talk some more about these things and many others. Looking forward to it.
Like I said, that's all we've got time for today. Just a reminder, you can find us across social media and Facebook and LinkedIn, as well as Twitter at Galbraith_group and Instagram at Galbraith Group. Please, of course, visit our website too, where you'll find some excellent articles from all our agents across all of our business streams. I've been Matt Finlay, and we'll be back in the new year. And until then, have a very Merry Christmas.